Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. Today we chat with Dr. James Smith, a professor of philosophy at the Calvin University, about his most recent book, How to Inhabit Time. Our conversation focuses on institutions and individuals reckoning with the past and discerning how to live in the light and shadows of this past, the role of liturgy, and finding stability within our community amidst rewriting our own stories. Thanks so much for joining me to discuss your book. I think we're just going to jump right in. No time to waste. We're going to go all in. So the first question I have for you is what was the motivation for this work? Just because it feels like so much of your own spiritual history and what you call dispensationalism informs a lot, or at least part of this book. So I guess I'm just wondering if we could dive in, define some of these terms that you sort of share, and then sort of situate them in some context.
Yeah, I mean, I think the motivation is... it sort of toggles back and forth between kind of personal journey and collective wrestling. So it is true that on the one hand, I'm trying to sort of work out some themes that I think I discovered in my own pilgrimage. And even, as you know, from the beginning of the book, from my own therapy and counseling. And that was, in a sense, looking for wholeness as a person was an occasion to sort of revisit the significance of history and time. So there's that kind of personal impetus. But as I was sort of inching towards this book, is also when I would say we in the United States collectively started to really grapple again with systemic racism, police brutality, the sort of national reckoning that George Floyd's murder occasioned was also a really kind of huge jolt in this project. And so I think both of those kinds of threads sort of drove the project.
Yeah, you have a line in there that I really appreciated. It was like, you consume the fruits of history that are both like nourishing and poisonous. And I feel like that just kind of makes me wonder like the role of institutions that they, and history in general, like how do you, you know, carry the weight of history, but then also convert it into something that is a little more healthy to hold on to, or sort of like with respect to, and still having respect for that, like the history that has occurred, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think we carry history, right? History isn't what's behind us. It's not what we've left behind. It's actually what we still carry with us. And so it's not a question of whether or not we, you know, history is what we carry. It's how we carry it. And I think the first sort of significant move or step towards integrity and integrality, we might say, is recognizing that. Do you know what I mean? In other words, I think a lot of naivete engenders a kind of ignorance that is dangerous because we or either personally or collectively, we think, oh, no, we're over that, or that's in the past, or we can forget that. And we don't realize that, oh, no, history is what we carry. So once, if we wake up to that reality, then I think it's a question of reckoning with it. And for me, reckoning is that mix that you were pointing out of, it's both, okay, where are the blessings and where are the curses? What do I need to sort of face and seek forgiveness for? And what can I receive gratefully as a gift that is propelling me or us into the future? And so I think that work of reckoning is kind of confrontational, like I have to face history, but it can also be characterized by gratitude and receptivity, because I can also see the possibilities that have been handed down to me. And I think it's that mix. And so you're always kind of sifting history, and we don't want to work with the illusion that we could step out of it or leave it behind, because if we did, we would also spurn our gifts.
Yeah. Throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as they say. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it kind of sounds like what you're saying is how to carry history is the first thing to do is to, like you said, like reckon with it, which means like understand that you are carrying it, but then to find like the good parts of that.
Yeah. So I don't think we can ever, you know, there's kind of like, you can drive into a ditch on either side. Yeah. Here. Do you know what I mean? You can sort of fall off both sides of the wagon, because on the one hand, you know, I think a lot of us and maybe a lot of Americans want to kind of like stick our heads in the sand and pretend the past is behind and let's get over it. And so that's kind of naive and ignorant, and then we won't reckon with our history. I think then there's another danger or risk on the other side, which is to just demonize our history, right? Like to just utterly and to almost kind of blame the past for not having the moral enlightenment that we have achieved given the time that we've had. And I that's why I do think it's this delicate tightrope of realizing that history is also what has made things possible for me. Do you know what I mean? None of us are self-made. None of us are just sheer will. We are all heirs of gifts of possibility that have been handed down, which is why I think the reckoning also has to include this sense of, where are the treasures buried too? Like what, and they might be, those treasures might be buried in terribly ugly containers, right, that we need to peel back and do away with. But I do think we can't just demonize our past either.
Yeah. I guess what's an example of something that like has that beauty that comes out of that very ugly box? Can you think of any?
Well, so yeah, and this is where I don't know what interests you more, whether it's the kind of collective sort of communal social dynamic or the personal dynamic. Let me try one of each. Okay, so I would say I'm an immigrant to the United States. I became a citizen several years ago, so I feel like I do come to the American experiment with slight outsider's eyes, right? And on the one hand, I'm really, really puzzled by those who seem to be just so like scandalized by something like the 1619 Project, which points out, listen, slavery is something that was woven into the warp and woof of the American experiment from the beginning. I just can't imagine why somebody would have a stake in denying that. It just seems so clear and obvious. On the other hand, I don't think that means that some of the ideals and ideas that nourished the fraught and failing aspects of the American experiment weren't liberative, right? Liberating. And in that sense, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King is a really, really interesting example of, I think, somebody who does this work of sifting history, of reckoning with the past, but also knowing sort of what to leave behind, but what to pick up and go forward with it. I think that's really instructive for us. But you can also imagine this at a personal level too. In the book, I appeal to a song by Brandi Carlile. I don't know if you know Brandi Carlile, but she's kind of a favorite singer-songwriter of mine. And she has this wonderful song about, it's written to somebody who has clearly hurt her and harmed her. And she says, by the way, I forgive you, and maybe I should thank you, right? Because there's a sense in which even though you hurt me and that was wrong, there's also a sense in which I could never be the person I am today if I hadn't undergone right. that. So there's always something to sort of be kind of strangely received from our history. And I think that's the trick.
Yeah. I feel you mentioned like the German word, I'm not going to try and pronounce it, but it's like holy history. It's like the unfurling of history as like the drama of salvation, I think I wrote down.
Heilsgeschichte. You know. It's a great word. It's a great word. It is. Yeah. In the sense that like, you know, you can see that things unfold in time that can be liberating and saving, and to see that history can have a kind of sacred character about it is part of the risk. That's risky, right? It's not the same as justifying all the evil things that have happened. It's not a matter of saying, oh, it had to be this way. It's more like saying, given that this is what has happened, given this is what we've endured, who can we be? And who are we called yeah. to be given that history? I think that's a very different exercise.
Yeah. I feel like that reminds me, I read this essay by Rebecca Solnit not too long ago, and it was kind of about fairy tales and how, like, what do you do when you are the main character in the middle of one? Of just like kind of like trusting great. That the story will resolve and that you have like the virtues and values that, you know, whatever the situation that threw you into this chaotic fairy tale like story that you need to persist through, that like you just have to trust that it'll come to an ending that will be good and rewarding.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. And it resonates with the theme that I talk about in How to Inhabit Time, which is another German term, we won't say the German, but thrownness. Uh-huh. Martin Heidegger talks about the sense that we are kind of thrown into our lives, right? And you kind of wake up and you're like, how did mm-hmm. I get here? And that's just the human condition. And now the question is, what are you going to do with that? Given that you find yourself thrown into this situation, what does it look like to kind of pick up what's been thrown your way and now forge a life going forward? So it sounds like Solnit's asking a similar
yeah.
thing.
I guess that makes me wonder, maybe like coming back to the idea of, you know, like institutions, be they local community ones, familial ones, church ones, government ones, sort of like, what is the, or like how, at each of those levels, like how can we really, like so much of kind of what you're saying, I'm thinking there's a lot of thoughts going on. I'm trying to formulate a question. Like you're saying that much of what we have is contingent on these big things. How does that, you know, how do we go forward in that? Like with like seasonality in mind, like in much of your book, you mentioned that there's like, you've a lot of meditations through like Ecclesiastes and like how there's different times for different things. So like how do you like, how do you, I guess, as an individual / community member / institution, those are all very different, I imagine, but maybe there's something similar in how you recognize, how do you recognize like where you are in time?
Right. So let's stick with the institutional level that you started with. And I think the first thing that has to happen is this kind of, first of all, the exercise does require a certain degree of kind of stepping back and reflection on who we are and when we are, right? So you do have to kind of like disembed yourself from just the grind of being part of an institution and step back and ask ourselves, how did we get here, right? Where did this – and it will sound crazy to say so, but for some communities, recognizing that their institution has a history – is part of the kind of revolution in mindset that has to happen, right? In other words, to realize that this institution didn't just like fall from the sky or drop down from heaven or wasn't just kind of like, even if it was founded by somebody they know, there's still a whole history behind it that got there. And in some ways, just realizing that institutions have a history should temper any illusions we have about our institutions for starters. And then I do think we have to like kind of undertake this sort of audit, if you will, of like, okay, what's the story we tell about our institution? And are there any blind spots in that story where we are, so is our story spin? Are we kind of like telling a narrative that forgets, you know, the brokenness of this institution or who was excluded by this institution? So I do think it's kind of this, it's this exercise in re-narration. And in some ways, what institutions need are outsiders to tell us what we look like, right? Or where we came from, because otherwise we can become echo chambers and we just sort of repeat the same stories to ourselves over and over again. And I think sometimes the gift of the outsider who comes in with new eyes and says, you know, do you not see this in the corner over here? Like there's, I think that's an important part of it. But the whole point of that exercise is to not just kind of wallow in failure or guilt or whatever. It's precisely to then actually be liberated from lies that we might've been telling ourselves for the sake of living into a different future, right? This is the opening of my book engages really significantly with James Baldwin, who I think is in the 20th century was one of just the great and most powerful American voices trying to do this for the sake of the institution we call, you know, the United States. I think this can happen on all kinds of levels. It can happen in a neighborhood. It can happen in a city. It can happen in a congregation. And I think it's not the sort of thing that's sort of one and done. It's more like continuing to build this into the rhythms of who we are and how we are together. And then I think we're more primed to sort of say, okay, so what should we be doing going forward? I don't know. Is that still too abstract to be helpful?
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. I feel like I think a lot about paradigm shifts, and that's kind of what it sounds like what you're saying is like you have this context and this narrative that you're saying, but then like you get this new piece of evidence, or maybe you get that outsider perspective that really, you know, changes how you think about what you're thinking about. And like, yeah, and that story that you're, you know, that you're telling yourself. So I think that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Kuhn, by the way. Here's a concrete example, somewhat concrete example. So, you know, I'm sitting here in the city of Grand Rapids. I'm thinking just a few blocks away is sort of downtown, and there are two interstates that course through the middle of it. And if I'm walking down on ground level, you know, there are these towering concrete spaces that have completely reorganized the way people live and move and have their being in the city. And, you know, for everybody in my lifetime, those things have always been there, right? So you could fall into the trap of imagining that they are just natural. Do you know what I mean? Like that's, oh yeah, that like these things might as well be a million years old because I've never experienced a city with them. But then you realize somebody, you know, talks to you and says, you know, well, certainly 100 years ago, those things weren't there. And do you know who was there when those things weren't there? And it was a very, very different, vibrant community. Oh, well, then why did those highways go in that space? Ah, well, who made that choice and who was harmed and who had the power to make those decisions? now all of a sudden you walk under a highway overpass downtown and you're like, oh, this is a fraught space. Yeah. And again, that's not just some big unveil and it's like, oh, we're terrible. It's like, yeah, there are terrible aspects to this. Now, what are we going to do? Now, what are we going to do? We're not tearing them down. So now what are we going to do? I think that sort of it's like gaining new eyes that show you that what's around you is the product of human cultural decisions over time. And what does it mean to grapple with that?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think that's a great example. Just, I feel like the tangibility of, you know, roads and processes and like you're going somewhere on roads usually. I think that's a good example of like that it's all part of like a process and not just like the infrastructure is the process.
That's right.
But that makes me wonder, much of this is not just about institutions, but a particular institution of like the church, it almost feels like. So I guess I'm kind of wondering if that applies as well to the church, because I feel like, or at least in my experience, a lot of church setting contexts or spiritual groups in general, they have an appeal to like capital T truth. And I guess that, and like, I don't know, where am I going with this question?
I think I get what you're saying, which is yes. So first of all, yes, absolutely. This all applies to the church. And it is true in How to Inhabit Time. I'm really interested in kind of like, what is the spiritual significance of realizing that human beings are historical creatures, right? That we're embedded in time. I think one of the sort of dangerous naivetes of a lot of churches is the illusion that they are not products of history, but somehow they just kind of like descend straight from the truth or from the sky or from heaven. And in that sense, they live under the illusion that they are kind of above time, right? That they are, or they're immune to time. And in the book, I say that the people imagine that they inhabit no when. Right? Like they have a view from nowhere because they inhabit no when. And I think that's an illusion for any creature. And by the way, for the record too, and I think it is good theology to say that no human creature is above time, right? So I think if churches, congregations, religious traditions take seriously the contingency of their own histories. That, by the way, doesn't mean that there's no spiritual truth. It just means that the way we experience God, the way that we know God, the way that we live out a spiritual life is itself a temporal, historical unfolding process. And it's also why religious communities, I would say, need to be open to reform, right? So it's not because they never descended from the sky to start with. So there's a sense in which the adventure of an ongoing relationship with even the eternal God sort of has to play out in time and history, which is why you keep seeing new things, new epiphanies, new unveilings, new revelations, which is why then institutions can't just get frozen in one time, right? What often happens, it's one of the reasons why I think nostalgia is a really powerful drug for religious traditions, because they imagine, oh no, we used to have this all locked down, and if we could just get back to that time, everything would be good. But the problem is, nostalgia is always a very edited version of the past. And what happens is they just freeze some particular time in amber and imagine, oh no, that was the golden age. And I just don't think that I don't think that's good theology, and I don't think it's a healthy way of being a creature.
Yeah, that almost sounds like the opposite of what you're saying earlier about like when you're uncover something within like your institution's history and you're just like, oh, this whole institution that is evil. This almost sounds like the opposite of like you see something that was good in the past and then kind of like throw out all of the bad parts.
Right. You just happily and conveniently ignore those things. Exactly. That's right. Whereas I think it's better to sort of be honest about those things. It's interesting. For example, within Christianity, which is my tradition, most streams, one of the core practices of gathered worship is confession, right? Where you sort of acknowledge all the ways that you have failed by the sins we have committed and omitted, the sins of omission and commission. And in that sense, you would expect, for example, people who are formed by a practice of confession to be willing to sort of face up to our failures. But that's not always the case, it turns out.
Yeah. I feel like that. You talk some in this book about liturgy, and I feel I personally love any type of religion or like any belief system that has like a strong liturgy. That's like always really compelling because like you get to embody and enact out a lot of core values within that belief system. But some of like what I personally wrestle with between like liturgy and tradition is like balancing that with like understanding the meaning of it and like the repeated symbology of it, but not like getting lost in it. And like, what do you keep and what is like a useful tradition to uphold given that? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I ritual and liturgical inheritances are another example of things that are historical, contingent. They've been formed over time. So there are gifts carried in them. But like all sort of in historical inheritances, we have to keep discerning what is needed now, what is faithful now. And I think that continuity with the past is really, really significant. Like you, I think the gift of ritual and liturgical forms is actually one of the ways that we resist the tyranny of the present, right? And just the narrowness of a kind of presentism. On the other hand, it can't just look like repristinating the past over and over again. It has to look like this kind of intentional inheritance, which might then sometimes need call for reform, renewal, change, adaptation, addition, to address what is it that God is calling us to in this moment of history and time. And so that's why I do think it's always a dynamic of grateful inheritance, but also critical reception, so that we discern what are the pieces of this that we want to carry forward, and what are pieces that actually are blind spots or are exclusive, that are shutting people out. I think those are all questions we need to keep asking.
Yes, and I feel like that process can get very exhausting. Is there like a spot, like any space for like stability in within all of this, even though this all of this is important to like reflect and critique and, you know, update. But like, yeah, it is like it's tiring to always be hypercritical and not necessarily trusting your liturgies and rituals that you're doing. So what? Yeah,
that's a good point. I think ideally what you kind of hope for is something like this kind of core spine, if you will, like this core plot line of a ritual or a liturgy that we can sort of entrust ourselves to. And then that can always be contextualized and adapted for different contexts and for different moments and seasons without having to like constantly relitigate what constitutes the core narrative plot line of the liturgy. I think that's exactly right. Because otherwise, there has to be continuity also so that we have multi-generational community around these things, right? Yeah. Like, I think it's really, just to take a very sort of not trite example, but a simple example, you know, if teenagers never have an opportunity to learn hymns that 90-year-olds sing, in a sense, it's very difficult for us to ever experience being part of that same community. Mm-hmm. And it also, we miss out on the opportunity. I think a lot, for example, about folks in my congregation and community who's, you know, struggle with Alzheimer's, they're in retirement homes and assisted living facilities, and they can't remember all kinds of things, but they can remember hymns. And that continuity, and for young people to then come and be able to sing the same story with them, I think is a very powerful expression of community. And so that's another argument, I think, for continuity and not constant reinvention.
Yeah, that makes sense. And to it, I feel like if something is tapping into some of that like essential truth, lowercase or capitalized there, then it would be consistent sort of throughout time, maybe no matter what.
That's right.
So sort of like part of all this, and you mentioned this like right at the beginning of your book about like you're urging readers to like slow down, like slowly read this book, and you have many stopping points of meditations. So what do you hope that sort of readers get out of these combinations of like scripture and reflection and like the urge to slow down?
Yeah. It's funny, Sarah. I think sometimes I hope the book frustrates people in just the right way, in the sense that I don't think the book is offering a set of lessons or formulas, or like it's not bullet point takeaways. It's more like, as you were saying before, a kind of like posture. And so what I'm hoping is that even the very form of the book invites people to practice a new kind of attention. That's why I describe it as contemplative at the end of the day. I think what contemplation is at the end of the day is a new and focal kind of attention to my moment, to my history, to when I am, but it's also a kind of attention to my neighbor, to my community, to my interior life. And in order to achieve that, you have to shut down and shut out a lot of chatter and distraction, which we all know is a big challenge today. But I actually think sort of the health of our society and the health of our individual lives going forward is staked on our ability to be able to do that kind of quieting and listening and dwelling. My hope is, and which is why the answer to the questions of like, when am I, are actually radically different depending on who we are, right? So I can't answer that for you. All I can do is kind of try to invite you into the practice of asking the question for yourself and getting to a place where you can listen to start to hear the ants are burbling. And I think if we can even achieve that, we will be in a much healthier place.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Like dwelling, and you use like discerning, the word discernment a lot.
Yes. For me, discernment is the whole point of reckoning with the past is precisely now, so we can be attentive and attuned to the present and discern, that is, ask, okay, what am I called to? What are we supposed to be doing? What is asked of us now, given where we've come from? And I don't think that's just formulaic. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, we are all called to love our neighbors, but what that means in your life, given your gifts and your history, and what it means in my life is kind of radically contextual. And so we need to each hear that sort of call on our lives so that we can answer it well for the sake of our communities.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful way to put it. A figure that you mentioned in your book that I come back to a lot is like Kierkegaard's Knight of Faith. I feel like within this context, it's like the Knight of Faith is constantly leaping, but he's like, it's like an understanding of where he is and like where he is aiming to go, that I hadn't really like ever really put that together in that way before.
Yeah. And the Knight of Faith is sort of, able to land in the present in a way that is completely animated by faith in the eternal, and at the same time completely comfortable enacting it in the now, in history, in the moment in which we find ourselves. And I think there are way too many religious folks who don't actually know how to be human. Right, or they don't really know how to be historical, and they're kind of always chomping at the bit to get to heaven above history. Whereas I think the Knight of Faith is the one who, as Kierkegaard says, knows how to land in the present and sort of walk faithfully in the now. And I think that's harder than it looks.
Yeah. I mean, Kierkegaard is like, I'm never going to be this person. He like totally.
Yes, exactly. It's very aspirational, right?
Always striving.
Yes. What does Kierkegaard say? I think something like, you know, I can never say I am a Christian. I can just say I'm becoming a Christian, which is very sympathetic.
I feel like that, you know, becoming, you know when you are and like you're going. It's like that process that we talked about.
Exactly.
Or different roads that we're, you know, taking or making or breaking, I suppose.
Yeah. That's right.
I don't think I have any other questions. Is there anything else about the book that you think is important for listeners to know about, hear about?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think I will say that the form of the book is really important to me, and the inclusion of like art and poetry and music and film is all kind of, for me, that's part of the project, right? It's a different way of inhabiting the world. And so my hope is that people don't just kind of look for the ideas or the message, but that it's almost, I hope it's, to read it is something of its own experience, even if the experience is meant to kind of catalyze reflection on ideas and convictions and things like that. So I suppose time will tell whether or not I was successful.
I really like the inclusion of like the different songs and lyrics and things. It kind of, I kind of feel like it goes back to like what you were saying about hymns, is like, you know, you get this cultural connection that you can tie these ideas to throughout history.
That's great. That's great. That's encouraging. Thank you.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I didn't know all of the songs or some of the references, but I'm like, sure. Fun. No.
That's the thing. That's the thing about music these days, right? So we're so stratified. I put together a Spotify playlist for the music that's mentioned in the book, and then music I was listening to while writing it.
So nice. We'll have to point readers to that as well then.
Oh, that'd be great.
I guess as a final question, what can readers look out for you in the future?
I'm just getting started on the next book, which is going to be on art and the art of contemplation.
Yeah, perfect.
So I'm really interested in the way contemporary art is its own sort of humbling challenge to us. Difficult beauty, I think I'm going to call it. And I'm really excited to get to work on that.
Aesthetics and morality is one of my favorite topics. So maybe I'll reach out to you again.
That's the space. We'll have to talk about that book in a few years.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your book with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for your interest.